Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Hello, yogis. I hope you are well. While I'm recording this at the beginning of January, I appreciate that you are not necessarily listening to it in January. And so I wanted to create something that would be relevant and interesting to you whenever you listen to it. Initially, I set out thinking that I wanted to do an episode about willpower and dharma and goal setting, and that is what I'm going to do. But as I was going down the rabbit hole of preparation for a Catherine-only podcast, I remembered that a while ago, I had seen the cover of a Gabrielle Bernstein book entitled The Universe Has Your Back. And I have so many thoughts, and I will explain why this episode is titled as a counter, The Universe Does Not Have Your Back, and it's okay. It's not because I'm some grumpy atheist. I have quite a few beliefs known as yoga. It's that this is so different from the yogic system, and it's actually a sort of new age spirituality, yoga, mostly Kundalini, and Christianity blend that I thought it was worth pointing out. Proximity to the yoga world doesn't necessarily mean reflective of yoga philosophy. So the universe does not have your back, and it's okay, is my way of saying I'm going to explain a little bit about my perception of where this whole the universe has your back thing came from, as well as how that dialogues with yoga philosophy. So we're going to start off philosophically, and then we're going to move toward what does this mean for willpower and self-control? And I'm going to talk about both of those things from a yoga philosophy perspective, as well as from a science perspective. And then we're going to talk about some techniques that can help you hone your own self-discipline, cultivate some willpower, and achieve some goals. So, who is Gabrielle Bernstein? I can't say I really know because I'm probably clearly not the biggest fan, but I do follow her on Instagram and I've known the name for a few years and have been gifted a couple of her books, which I admittedly have never read. She is a public speaker. My impression of her is that she has taken A Course in Miracles, which I'll explain in a moment, and then synthesized it into her own blend of A Course in Miracles meets New Age spirituality meets kind of like a dose of Kundalini yoga into Gabrielle Bernstein's prescription for a spiritually connected good life. I remember noticing once that she wears shockingly tall shoes. And then I actually saw her at an event. We were in the same room and she is very tiny. So now I understand the shockingly tall shoes. I'm familiar with A Course in Miracles, which is this tome written by a psychologist named Helen Schumann. And is it Helen Schumann or is it Schuckman? I had to pause and find out if anyone actually ever pronounced her last name. But everyone feels very cozy with Helen, it seems. So Helen was a psychologist and a researcher, and she worked at Columbia University for 20 years until her death. So this woman is no slouch, but she's also Christian, and she transcribes the Course in Miracles from an inner voice guided by Jesus. So I think this is where people who are critical of Christianity would probably take off with some critiques. But first, I want to pause and say that she says, and her commenters have said, that the form was all hers, but the source was Jesus's love made manifest. Now, if we turn to the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Lord, taken from the Mahabharata, and this is a text that informs a lot of yoga practice because it is literally the text of the yoga of action. How do we live in the world? How do we live well in the world so as to do the least harm and the most good while we are here? And Krishna, the avatar of Vishnu, the sustainer god, says to his pupil Arjuna, "Those who worship me and meditate on me constantly without any other thought, I will provide for their needs. Those who worship other gods with faith and devotion also worship me, Arjuna, even if they do not observe the usual forms. I am the object of all worship, its enjoyer and Lord. But those who fail to realize my true nature must be reborn." So, hold on for a second. That's from chapter 9, by the way. So when I teach the Bhagavad Gita, I might have mentioned this before, that I say that we can read Krishna as saying those who worship love when he says those who worship me. So he has similar messaging to Jesus of Nazareth in Christianity, which is those who practice in love, those who come to love, those who live in love are living a spiritual life. But he also talks about meditation. And I've read before in different analyses on Buddhism and Christianity and where they dialogue and Buddhist Christian communities, that meditation is the common denominator to so many spiritual practices. Meditation is where we have common experience and common healing. More on that later. But all this is to say that the Course in Miracles is considered a Christian text, though it is not always used that way. I'm familiar with Marianne Williamson. You might be familiar with her from her quotation, "Our deepest fear," which is amusingly often attributed to Nelson Mandela. And when I saw Marianne Williamson speak, she noted that that quotation was attributed to him, even though it includes a passage to the effect of, "We ask ourselves, who am I to be talented, fabulous, and beautiful?" And went on to say that she wasn't sure that, Nelson Mandela was that concerned with whether people were feeling fabulous or not. But she was, of course, very flattered that that would be attributed to him. Off the show notes on the website, I've linked to you a video where she explains her rise to fame and her work with A Course in Miracles. So Gabby Bernstein, like Marianne Williamson, has taken a text that speaks to her and synthesized it for her purposes. Now, she seems like the slim feminine version of Tony Robbins in lots of ways, right? Those big stadium spiritual speakers. And here's a couple of things that I think need to be said in regards to this line of thinking that differ from yoga. Initially, if you're confused and wondering what all this has to do with yoga philosophy and pursuing yoga, most of us who are listening, not all, but most of us who are listening have grown up in cultures that are shaped heavily with a Christian history and with a capitalist economy and dominant political paradigm. So what does that mean? It means that even if you are not a practicing Christian, you have a high level of familiarity with the system and its modes of thinking have influenced how we are living. I think in the New Age spirituality realm, we are particularly influenced by American evangelical Christianity, because that big stadium celebrity approach is it's very unique to American evangelicals, which I think I learned the most about the original evangelical priest Billy Graham by watching The Crown. So that idea that spirituality could be a form of entertainment. And Marianne Williamson, I mean, like the rest of them, she's got her her critics. And she said, you know, "I don't have followers. I have an audience." And Barbara Streisand has an audience, but no one criticizes her. Now, of course, Barbara Streisand isn't moralizing in her shows, although in social media these days and political celebrities, that line is getting blurred. But she made the point. She's not out to cultivate followers. And whichever person you're listening to, their tactics are tried and true ones. Affirmations are very powerful. We use them in yoga through mantra and through sankalpa all the time. And yeah, if you got a bunch of people looking to feel good in a room and just had them chant, "I feel good, I feel good, I feel good," I bet we would all leave feeling pretty good. If this is not what happens at these events, please feel free to email me and correct me. I'm just going off of what I've observed. So back to Gabrielle Bernstein and why the universe does not have your back, but it's okay. So I've put a link in the show notes about surrendering your goals to the universe and about how our goals can get in the way. She's not bashing goals. She's saying that goals are fine, but then you need to surrender them to the universe. This is where I think there is that strong influence of Christianity, because Christianity has a couple of concepts that are important to note. One is of predestination. Now, predestination is a contentious topic in Christianity circles, I have learned, and it's essentially the idea that there is an omniscient God who is ever knowing. So he knows everything that has happened and everything that will happen. So it creates space for sin to exist. And then, of course, a Christian system of achieving salvation and blissful eternity should you go through certain actions and achieve forgiveness. Now, I'm pretty sure that whether you get in through the pearly gates or not, I think that differs denomination to denomination of Christianity. But again, it's that surrendering to the higher spirit because they already have a plan. And so this is really what the universe has your back reminds me of, is that there is this ever-loving, present, patriarchal force that is watching out for you and or knows exactly what's going to happen. And this has been philosophers' main criticism of Christianity comparative to a lot of Eastern religions, because karma seems to make a much better explanation of why there are bad things going on in the universe. There was that book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. My understanding has always been that whether it is yoga or Buddhism, we believe in samsara. We believe in the cycle of death and rebirth. And so it depends on the system of yoga that you are looking at, but essentially you have a karmic debt or credit to resolve. You're kind of aiming for neutrality on karma. And when you resolve all your karma by living in right action and fulfilling your dharma, you will no longer go through the incarnation cycle. So that means that you could be a really good person this time around, and yet you could have had a karmic debt from a previous lifetime. And so then you need to resolve that karmic debt. But, and I can't remember if I've just said this in workshops or if I've said it on the podcast before, Michael Stone, in his book, The Inner Tradition of Yoga, he talks about how we shouldn't always look at machinations of the universe and pretend that we can quantify them and understand them. So when we're faced with real tragedy, best not to go to someone and be like, karmic debt, right? It's for us to work with to help ourselves navigate difficult situations with increased grace. Also from yoga philosophy, the universe is not a friendly place. It is not a place to just hang out, surrender, and allow. And this is the really key difference. In yoga philosophy, we have the mahagunas. And the mahagunas are the qualities, that's what guna means, quality. They're the qualities of the universe. And they represent the energetic, I call sways, of happenings, and then they are also reflected in your mind. So this forms the basis for Vedic psychology, the gunas, the mahagunas. And the mahagunas are rajas, tamas, and sattva. Rajas is potential energy. It's kinetic, it's upward moving. It's that spark in the fire. Tamas is inertia, it's darkness, it's low, it's downward moving energy, it's quiet. Sattva is light, it's easeful, it's bliss, it's peacefulness. There are different ways of analyzing and working with the gunas, and naturally people disagree on how they enact themselves. But we are always under influence of the gunas. And if you're interested in Ayurveda, they play a key role in Ayurvedic assessment as well. So we can see this in how nature moves, right? Springtime into summer, super rajasic time, upward moving. It's bright outside. Stuff is happening. Things are growing and moving and producing. And then autumn is a time of downward slide into tamas, right? But where's the sattva? This is a really good question to ask, because you might have already labeled tamas bad, rajas awesome. And that's, of course, indicative of our culture that we live in. Productivity, upward moving, doing the things, willpower, all so good. Whereas we label tamas downward moving, inertia, very bad. But there's nothing inherently bad or good about spring, summer, autumn, winter. They just are. How we experience them determines how we feel about them and how we qualify them. The play of the gunas happens outside of our conscious minds. But some people would say that we move through a rajasic state out of tamas towards sattva and then backslide back down into tamas. But again, I think this takes a kind of judgmental approach against tamas. Another really beautiful way of thinking about it is that there is only sattva when rajas or tamas is appropriately harnessed. So when wouldn't we be appropriately harnessing tamas? The evening is a tamasic time. We wind down. But if you stay up looking at your screens or working really late or, imbibing things that are fiery like alcohol, then we are not appropriately harnessing the tamasic energy of the evening. Similarly, if we're struggling to get out of bed in the morning and we're not keeping the promise of the alarm that we set to ourselves, we are not appropriately harnessing the rajasic energy of the morning. So maybe there's no such thing as pure sattva. It's just we live a sattvic life when we cultivate our attention and observe the qualities of the nature around us and then harmonize with nature, right? That's Ayurveda. So this is a fundamental difference between the culture that most of us have been raised in and yoga philosophy. The influence of Christianity tells us that the universe is unknowable, right? That all-knowing God knows everything and we know nothing about their intent and their rationale. But yoga philosophy actually says that the universe is somewhat knowable because you are a part of it. So when we think of yoga as a path for refinement, for improving our discernment, it is helping us pay closer attention to all the signs of the movement of energy in the universe so that we can be less affected by it. My teacher loves to say that you want to be specific with the universe, because if you're not specific, you could say something like, I'm going to be a student forever. And then the universe will send you a pile of lessons to help you learn. But if you say, I'm going to be a student, and that looks like signing up for this course on this day and attending and achieving this certification, there's a lot less room for the universe to muck you about. So this is why goal setting is a useful tool for yogis, why I engage with it myself. If we are looking to set some goals, typically we're looking to hone some willpower in a particular way. The late Stuart McLean, the Canadian version of, what's that guy's name? A Prairie Home Companion, that guy. So our Stuart McLean, he talked about setting achievable goals like only buying the really nice tomatoes. Not a lot of willpower required to buy the really nice tomatoes. But usually it's because we want to do something, we want to not do something, right? We want to cultivate adding something or subtracting something that comes with some difficulty. And yoga posture practice sometimes gives us the incorrect impression that if we just tried harder or knew better, we could achieve a posture with relative ease. And this is what I talk about in my functional movement-based trainings, is that sometimes doing the posture is not the way to get better at doing the posture. In that instance, I talk about things like prerequisite mobility. How do particular joints need to function to achieve the range of movement demanded of the entire system in a particular posture? So for example, if you wanted to do a headstand, you need to be able to stack your spine vertically, obviously inverted, while your legs stay straight enough to be able to walk your hips up over your shoulders and maintain that straight spine. Now, if your hamstrings and back of your legs don't have the extensibility to walk yourself into that position, then your bum is going to stay curled back behind your base, and getting into that headstand is going to be really challenging. You might start hopping and then you're going to tip over. So sometimes there are little techniques that a teacher reveals to us and we're like, oh, now it lands for me. But sometimes we actually need to move away the thing we think is a good goal, like a headstand, and there's nothing really that great about a headstand. But spine to hamstring extensibility, good goal. Shoulder flexion, good goal. The ability to bear weight on your arms inverted, not a terrible goal. Though I would argue that some people are better suited for handstand and some people not at all. And there's lots and lots of opportunities to go upside down with support in ways that are functional. Just to let you know that I'm not advocating for one way of doing inversions. So you either need to figure out these exercises or you need some substitution for some of the strength, which is where some of those headstand props come from. And you also need to find out what you don't know, what you can't perceive about your practice. And the best ingredients for achieving this recipe is, of course, a teacher to support you. So often it's not just a matter of a lack of willpower. It's a matter of a lack of knowledge or opportunity. And it's a matter of setting ourselves up for failure when it's a matter of subtracting something from our lives. Smokers often fail to anticipate when they will be tempted to smoke. An expert in alcoholism was on public radio the other day, as some people decide to do this thing called Dry January. And she was saying that they don't necessarily link the behaviors that are facilitating the behavior that you're trying to stop. For example, she talked about how Saturday night hockey games may be a ritual with buddies where you're drinking alcohol and watching the game, or you're playing hockey and the game is followed with drinks. So she was saying that you either need to strategize not doing those activities or recruit help and make it a dry Saturday night, or talk to your friends about your goals and how your collective behavior is preventing you from achieving them. One of the things that irks me the most around conversations about goal setting and willpower has to do with what we identify as undesirable and what we identify as desirable. These conversations almost entirely focus on restraints from and adoption of unhealthy and or healthy habits. I was listening to a podcast on goal setting recommended by a student. Hi, Kay. And I really enjoyed a lot of it, but I was particularly bummed when the host and the guest kept talking about, you know, because we don't want to be overweight anymore and we don't want to be lazy anymore and we don't want to be, you know, they just kept harping on these two qualities, which I might have mentioned before. Ayurveda says that there are many ways to be imbalanced. And again, it's this cultural preference for labeling certain attributes as imbalance and not recognizing others as imbalance. Obviously, I have a passion for exercise, healthy eating, etc., but you'll rarely find me exposing the benefits of something like clean eating, as I find it troubling that there's a suggestion there's such a thing as dirty eating, thus dirty people, right? That comes with some really heavy connotations. And there's lots of research that demonstrates that many people with food insecurity, it's not that they necessarily are trying to sabotage themselves and not eat well. They don't have access to education and they don't have easy access to food, not just in terms of good whole food coming to them from food banks, but even grocery stores. Even if they had the money to buy food, a lot of people are restricted in their movement. And so they can't get to places that have produce. So it's just a lot more complicated than this food is good and that food is bad. This is to say there's nothing morally superior about our habits, but we love to moralize them. I've mentioned in other talks that you can do yoga and meditation and be a terrible person. You'll just be a terrible person with more energy and no back pain. So among all of these goals and willpower practices, I'm a big fan of advocating for cultivating softer skills as well, like becoming a better listener, becoming a better partner, becoming a more present parent, etc. Cultivating kindness in the workplace. My goodness, I wish they would create a person who has to do that in every office. Some of the things I read recently on willpower, they're actually a tad out of date, it turns out. But one I turned to was because the author is a yogi, actually. And that's Kelly McGonigal's The Willpower Instinct. And she talks about how self-control evolved early for humans, as our compulsions to survive are pretty powerful stuff. You know, that includes finding quick calories, reproducing, securing shelter. And these impulses drive us to behaviors that are not always helpful for communal living. They need to be tempered with self-control so that should we be ill or should we require support, we have community and protection because we haven't alienated all our buddies by sleeping with their partners or stealing their food. One of the things I do quite off the bat disagree with McGonigal about are her statements that willpower initially involved as something that distinguishes us from animals, and now it's what distinguishes us from each other. She goes on to list all the attributes that someone with willpower shows, including a longer lifespan. I think it's important to note here that willpower and class thus have a relationship. Just because someone with high willpower lives a longer life, you know, unless you're looking at their socioeconomic status, we don't know that that's a direct correlation. It could be that people without financial or food insecurity likely have higher willpower because their lives are simply less stressful to bear. Willpower, according to this book, although I'm going to problematize this in a moment, but according to this book and a lot of thought in behavioral psychology for a long time, willpower is a finite resource. If you are working a job and still living in poverty, you doubtful have sufficient willpower to exercise habits deemed healthy. My critique is not a new one. There are many meditators and spiritual practitioners who criticize the use of a lot of these practices as being for the purpose of advancing the aims of capitalism and other entrenched systems of oppression. What does that mean? Think of the number of times that you see articles and blog posts pushing meditation for increased productivity or using yoga techniques to help people do better work. On the one hand, we definitely want more opportunities to practice. On the other hand, some people get upset and are reasonably critical of the use of these techniques intended for spiritual freedom, for increasing the company's bottom line through less absenteeism and depression or low productivity. Personally, I come out on the side that it's better for companies to advocate for meditation and yoga, whatever the reason, because we're going to be waiting a long time if we were waiting for everyone to have intentions that align with ours. I agree with lots in the book, though, including when she states that academic success is better predicted by willpower rather than intelligence. I have had so many conversations in my teenage years with friends who were brilliant beings that could not get their act together. And they would often state that grades were not indicators of intelligence. But I think that's subjective, depending on whether you think it's intelligent or not to purposefully flunk out of your classes. I also find it fascinating that willpower and self-control are stronger determinants of successful leadership than charisma. This is really interesting from my position as what I hope is a career yoga teacher, assuming I still get to keep doing this in the future, as you see a lot of people with a lot of fire in their constitution at higher and higher levels of teaching, right? Because charisma is a fire quality, and fire gives us the ability to transform. So a reminder that we all have fire to us, we all have fire element. But our fire may be low or perhaps needs some stoking if we're having a difficult time transforming information. So good teachers are good transformers, right? They can take big concepts and then deliver them in ways that people can understand. If you have fire, people can bask in your glow. Of course, if you have rampant fire, they are incinerated by your eyes. Charisma seems to be a critical component of the international yoga teacher circuit. However, most people are not trying, to be international yoga teachers. They're just trying to be yoga teachers. And consistency is one of the most valuable qualities of a yoga teacher. You need to show up and your students need to know what to expect from you. The portion of the book, The Willpower Instinct, about how our brains develop is a little old hat to me these days, looking at how evolution tends to add on to rather than replacing old mechanisms. So you might have heard things like the reptile brain and that we have different levels of brain function, one responsible for impulses and another responsible for what we might call higher executive function. So this means that the primitive parts of the brain, they have very little impulse control. And so we lean into aggression or the strong desire for fat and sugar. And this still exists even though we now have a prefrontal cortex, that executive center, responsible for higher reasoning and stronger self-control. The part that I found in here that was super cute, though, was about how we relate to both the person who wants to modify their diet and eat well as the part of us who just wants the cookie. There's a recommendation that we name that part of ourselves who engages in self-destructive or self-limiting behaviors, like the cookie monster or the procrastinator. Mine would be the phone face. Right? When you just drop all expression off your face and just can't get off your phone. McGonagall makes the excellent point that we need to be aware of how much control we need to exercise if we are to set ourselves up for success. For example, people were asked to assess how many decisions they needed to make around food in a day, and they guessed around 17 or 18. In fact, apparently we make well over 200 decisions about food in a day. This relates to Ayurveda, which early on recognized that decision fatigue is a real thing. Distracted people are also more likely to give in to temptations. Oh my goodness, evidence of all the effectiveness of mindfulness practices and Ayurveda's recommendation that you focus on your eating without distraction. All of this is conceptualized before smartphones. When your mind is preoccupied, you are more likely to give in to your impulses than your plans. So couple this together, and we need to plan ahead, being aware of the fact that we have a lot of decisions to make, and then we need to execute the plan in a singular, focused way. Our prefrontal cortex gets bigger and faster at processing self-control when we meditate. It's great news. Blood flow increases to that area of the brain during meditation, not unlike blood flow increasing to muscles during exercise. If you read anything about willpower and self-control research, you will find that the techniques for improving these things almost always include meditation and exercise. Meditation and exercise are proven to help you exert greater willpower and self-control, which is likely one of the reasons that yoga is so popular these days, since it, fingers crossed, blends those two. Yet another reason for good shavasanas, everyone. They also help increase heart rate variability. So psychologists call heart rate variability the willpower reserve. And I've linked to a Harvard article off the show notes if you'd like to read more on this, as it may be one of the only physiological indicators of self-control and successful willpower. Basically, it means that people who look at something they are trying to resist, their heart rate increases. They have higher levels of self-control than people whose heart rate does not increase when they look at something that they are trying to resist. Basically, heart rate variability, it's the distance between your heartbeats. But the higher your heart rate variability, the healthier relationship you have with your nervous system. The lower the heart rate variability, the more panicked and fight, flight, freeze mode you are in, thus not as healthy relationship with your nervous system. This all has to do with fight, flight, freeze, autonomic nervous system stuff. The thing I found fascinating were the factors that influence heart rate variability other than meditation and exercise, which includes eating plant-based food. What? People seem to think that vegans exercise tons of self-control, but maybe it's that their diet actually helps them exercise all that self-control. So when we say that we are eating well and eating organic and trying to get a good night's sleep and meditating, exercising, we could say that we're working on our heart rate variability, because basically anything that puts stress on your system is going to stress your ability to exercise self-control. So that could even include air quality. But like I said, don't worry. Meditation, mindfulness practices, engaging in spiritual practice, and exercise all help these things. So perhaps as you are entering your 2019 or wherever you are in your year, if you're listening to this at another time, as you approach your goal setting, make sure that you have consistent practice, because that is an excellent goal to help fulfill all your other goals. Thank you so much for choosing to listen. If you are able to be in the Ottawa area this February, I have two offerings: a weekend of Ayurvedic yoga, February 2nd, 3rd, and then a yin and mellow yoga teacher training, February 21st to 24th. And if you are in the Toronto area or could be, I have the biggest offering at the Toronto Yoga Conference that I've ever had. I'm there every day of the conference, and on Sunday I'm offering a 4.5-hour training called the Accessible Yoga Teacher's Toolkit. But either way, namaste for now, yogis.